Welcome to the Oh Wow Science Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by the UIF Adult Education Program at the Unalaska Learning Center. At UIF, we honor and recognize that we are on Indigenous Onangam Dananggin land where this podcast is being recorded. My name is Tatiana, and my goal is to bring you fun science facts and ideas every Friday at noon and Saturday at 4 p.m. on KUCB. Episode 10, Anthropology. Welcome to the last episode in this Oh Wow Science series. For this episode, I want to cover the field of anthropology, a very large subject that includes everything about who humans are and how we became who we are today. I'm going to cover our diverse modern cultures, the stone tools that shaped our skills, and go back in time to the early humans from whom we descended. So in short, anthropologists study people. And they do this by considering the past to see how human groups lived hundreds or thousands or millions of years ago and what was important to them. And I'm going to start just briefly talking about the three subfields of anthropology that scientists usually focus on, which are the following. Number one, studying how people lived in the past is the study of archaeology. So think like the movies Indiana Jones, where there's a search for old artifacts in order to solve the mysteries of the past. Number two, some anthropologists also consider what makes up our biological bodies and genetics, as well as our bones, diet, and health. They compare humans with other animals to see what we have in common with them and what makes us unique. This is the study of biological anthropology. And number three is some anthropologists also try to understand how people interact in cultural and social relationship in the present time. So for example, with families and friends, they look at the different ways people dress, communicate, eat, and have other traditions or rules of conduct in different societies. And this is called cultural anthropology. So those are the three branches I'm going to cover in this episode. Let's go back and look at each one in depth and some of the examples that I find fascinating about each one. I actually studied all these three subfields in college before I switched to biology and focused on biology instead of anthropology. My favorite, though, was always biological anthropology, so that makes sense as well as to why I switched. So let's talk about archaeology first. Like I said, archaeologists study human culture by analyzing the objects people have made. They carefully remove from the ground such things like pottery and tools, and then they map the locations of houses, trash pits, and burials from a long time ago in order to learn about the daily lives of a people that lived in a time that's long gone, so we don't have maybe any written evidence or any documentation about those people. So this could be a really long time ago, or maybe not even that long ago. And have you ever heard of stone tools? So stone tools made humans who we are. You might have seen some replicates of stone tools in gift shops, especially if you've gone to a national park. So let's go back in time to when stone tools first appeared in the archaeological record. So stone tools are some things that archaeologists would find when they're digging up soil to find evidence of human cultures or human life and human towns. So the earliest evidence of humans using stone tools comes from around 3.4 million years ago. The use of tools in general is a skill that very few animals possess in the animal kingdom, which includes us. So we know that this is something that makes humans special. Just look all around us now and at all the tools we use to live the modern lives that we do, like cell phones. Those are tools too. They're technological tools. But what's more special about stone tools during their first appearance in the archaeological record is that these tools are tools that humans made, meaning they're taking an object and modifying it to be something else. Knowing that, it's for sure that humans have probably been using tools for a lot longer and earlier than 3.4 million years ago. And by that, I mean they probably were using rocks and sticks in general for whatever they needed. But the making of their own tools, the modification of things to serve a new purpose, is something really complex. And actually, the way archaeologists found this earliest evidence of stone tools millions of years ago was because they found sharpening marks on animal bones, which could have been from trying to cut the meat off the bone and leaving cut marks from that. If you've never seen a stone tool, imagine a triangle shape that's made out of a rock with a sharp, pointed edge. That's the more familiar shape of a stone tool. And this one acted like a knife or a shear knife, but there were other types of stone tools like choppers or hammers that were larger. And stone tools were used for millions of years, and they were even used up until the 19th century, which is the 1800s, because it's a really foolproof way of getting a razor sharp edge. And the way you make a stone tool, by the way, and you can do this too if you learn how to, but the way you do it is by smashing / hitting two rocks together at a specific angle. You're basically sharpening a rock with the other rock, and the one rock will flake off bit by bit until you can get such a sharp blade that you can perform surgery. In fact, here in the Aleutian Islands, the native Alaskan Unangan were able to perform surgery all the way back to 10,000 BC. And I assume they used stone tools for this, like every society at that time, since knives were not invented until 4,000 years ago. What's really interesting about stone tools is that they also carry cultural tradition. So this is a time, imagine 3.4 million years ago, when humans were not only evolving biologically, but a time when they started passing on knowledge from one another and to the next generations. Because the way you make a stone tool matters. It requires very careful knowledge, and it also differs between people. That's the definition of culture. Different tribes made different types of stone tools. And also, as humans evolved, they evolved their tools alongside them, as you can see by your cell phone in your hand. So how about my favorite subfield in anthropology? Biological anthropology. These scientists seek to understand how humans adapt to different environments. Biologically speaking, what causes disease and early death, and how did humans evolve from other animals? To do this, they study humans, living and dead, other primates, such as monkeys and apes, and other human ancestors through the fossil record. So, biologically, what makes a human a human? Compared to a chimpanzee or a gorilla, our closest cousins, well, we have the large brain size, of course, but we know that other animals, like parrots even, have large brains too. there's the tool use, like the stone tools and other tools. And we know that some other animals use tools occasionally too, like chimpanzees and even crows. But there's one thing that makes us very different from our closest cousins, and that's walking on two legs instead of four. This is called bipedalism. I just want to clarify really quick the idea of evolution here, because it can be tricky to understand how chimpanzees are our closest cousins. And what I mean by that is that about 6 million years ago, chimps and humans shared a common ancestor. And around this time, our lineages split. One went into the human lineage and another went into the chimps. This is just to clarify that we did not come from chimps. They evolved parallel to us, just like we evolved. So if you imagine a road, the road can split into new roads a bunch of times, and new roads go off of that road. And the last time our road split, 6 million years ago, was what gave us humans and chimps as the two new roads. So back to bipedalism. It's actually been fairly difficult to figure out why humans decided to stand up and walk on 2 feet about four million years ago, which is when we think this happened. So there's several theories here. The fact is, though, that bipedalism really changed our anatomy and our pelvises, and sometimes not for the better. So it must have been very, very important to evolve bipedalism for early humans. One theory for this is that at the time, humans had to travel large areas, and walking on 2 feet saved you energy compared to having to walk on all 4 feet. And if you have more energy, you can walk further and gather those berries or go hunting or whatever it is that you're doing for survival. This theory is also tied to the environment that the early human was in. So instead of thick forests or jungles that require four legs to travel, the early human ended up in a savanna-type habitat with few trees and lots of open areas. Maybe due to just natural changes in environment. And that's how evolution happens. You know, you have a change in environment. And now it requires different survival mechanisms, and so you adapt. There's other theories for bipedalism that aren't as supported, and just for fun, I'm going to give these to you. So these include humans having to stand up above tall grasses to look for predators, or humans standing up to reach fruits on the trees, or even humans needing a longer body to swim. So that's the least likely theory for bipedalism, since most early humans didn't live near the water and didn't spend most of their time inside the water. But these ideas of evolution can be hard to understand, and sometimes throwing a bunch of theories out there helps bring out the good one to light. And some of the things that have changed with bipedalism is you might have also noticed that your feet, the human foot, is a lot different than a chimpanzee foot because our feet have smaller toes. We also have an arch in our foot rather than flat feet like chimps. And this is because when we walk, we transmit weight from the heel and then into the toes when we're walking, since it helps. It helps the bipedalism. That's just some physical requirements there. That's just some physics for you of energy transfer. So there's lots of other changes in anatomy that happen to us due to bipedalism involving the brain, the spine, our knees, and the way we give birth. Fun fact, it is much more difficult to give birth when you're bipedal rather than when you walk on four legs because of the pelvis changes that we underwent. Now, let's talk about all the human races that have evolved through the million years of human evolution. So here's our entire evolution in a very, very brief summary. We split from chimpanzees around 6 million years ago, and the earliest bipedal example is around 4 million years ago. Not too long after that, we have the first tools called stone tools around 3.4 million years ago. We migrated out of Africa between 2 and 1 million years ago to go up north into Europe and Asia, and then into North America and South America through the Bering Sea that was frozen at some point. And then 1.5 million years ago was the first use of fire, which really accelerated our evolution. It helped us cook our food, which made our brains grow bigger, and it kept us warm in northern climates, as well as protected us from predators. So this allowed us to migrate further in all probability. One of the most famous extinct human races are the Neanderthals. They evolved after those first humans migrated out of Africa. But actually, modern humans, so us, kept evolving in Africa. And there was a second wave of migration of these modern humans that we descend from less than 200,000 years ago. When modern humans moved up into Europe and Asia, they encountered these Neanderthals, and over time, the Neanderthals in these areas went extinct. I guess they couldn't outcompete the modern humans, probably because we modern humans used more tools and better tools for our survival. And it doesn't really take much for a species to go extinct. It can be just a slight decrease in population and it will eventually vanish. But actually, we still don't know for sure why this happened or how quickly or slowly it happened to the Neanderthals. Another fun fact is that Neanderthals were redheads. You might have heard that you have some Neanderthal DNA in you, and that's because modern humans did interbreed probably the entire time they were living alongside with this other race of humans. It's really hard to say if they lived together or were very separated and maybe only saw each other occasionally. But the fact is, they were different races of humans during our evolution. Because humans lived geographically separated by land, there weren't that many people back then, and over a long time, they became different races. When modern humans started to migrate out of Africa, about 200 to 150,000 years ago, it's certain that they encountered several human races on their journey that didn't make it to our modern times, like the Neanderthals. There was also a discovery of an extinct human race on some islands, and I can't remember exactly where, but I remember that they evolved to be quite small people and that there weren't that many of them. And that's interesting and probably a reflection of living on an island. A lot of changes happen to people and cultures that end up living on islands because resources are not as abundant or as diverse, depending on the island, I guess. So at the moment in history, the modern human is the single race that survives at the moment. We may look slightly different in different parts of the world and have different skin colors, but we are 99.999% genetically the same and are definitely, scientifically speaking, not different races, no matter how different we look on the outside. So fast forward to the invention of agriculture. Up until about 10,000 years ago, humans lived as hunter-gatherers. This is around the time agriculture and animal domestication was invented, and humans were able to live in larger groups because of agriculture. 6,000 years ago was the first human state. So ancient Greece laid the foundation for Western culture only about 3,000 years ago. And ancient Greece is just like one of the largest that happened at the time. And compare our evolution to the first mammals who appeared 210 million years ago, or dinosaurs who lived from 200 to 65 million years ago, or reptiles who evolved over 300 million years ago. Modern humans' life is only about 0.001% of how long mammals have been on Earth. So when you think of a whale or a bird, for example, think about how much more ancient they are than us. We are very recent in terms of the Earth's evolution. You might be wondering, how do we know some of this stuff? Well, it's not only digging up bones in Africa or exploring ancient caves in Europe. It's not only analyzing jaw and teeth structure for evidence of the early humans' diet or looking at their pelvis and feet for anatomy. It's also molecular biology and genetics. Scientists can take pieces of bone, of fossil bone, and extract whatever DNA might be present in them. One really interesting thing we've discovered is the concept of the so-called mitochondrial Eve. Mitochondrial Eve is defined as the most recent woman from whom all living humans descend in an unbroken line. Actually, maybe not all living humans, many living humans. And this line is purely through the mothers and through the mothers of those mothers, back until all lines converge on one woman. And this woman lived about 150,000 years ago. So the way this works is mothers pass on an unchanged mitochondria to their children. And then those daughters pass it on onto their children, creating the female line of an unchanged mitochondria, because it doesn't change when you pass it on. And mitochondria is a part of your cell. It's the part that makes energy in the form of ATPs. So both men and women have mitochondria. And it's a special part of the cell because it looks like a bacteria cell that co-evolved probably with our animal cells by partnering up with it. So now this animal cell that we have and this mitochondria are one unit, working together and completely dependent. But a long time ago, it used to be its own cell, so that's why it has its own DNA, and it just gets passed down from the mother. This mitochondrial Eve that we're talking about is only for our species, which is called Homo sapiens sapiens. If you wanted to, you could calculate the Eve for other groups, like the species before we split from Neanderthals and so on. But our human mitochondrial Eve is 150,000 years old. And this does not mean that she was the only woman alive then, or was the only woman with successful kids. It just means that the other women's lines got broken somewhere along the way by only having boys, for example. And maybe the lineage from those boy children are still alive today. We're just talking about the unbroken maternal line, basically the oldest line of generations that didn't get broken, is 150,000 years old. How cool is that? And it kind of blows your mind. Let's move on to cultural anthropology, the third subfield. Quote, courtesy, modesty, good manners, conformity to define ethical standards are universal. But what constitutes courtesy, modesty, very good manners, and definite ethical standards is not universal. It is instructive to know that standards differ in the most unexpected ways. End quote. By Franz Boas. Cultural anthropologists want to know what people think is important in their society and the rules they make about how they should interact with one another. It sounds pretty straightforward here, you know, that we only act based on our beliefs and morals, but it really isn't, because the way we act as people is basically how we learn to act from our parents and our culture. We have so many rituals in our daily life that define our culture and are solely based on where we're from. We have so many things that are cultural that we don't realize are cultural. From the way we speak, to whether we like confrontation or not, to the way we eat or what foods we eat. I think food is one of the biggest and most obvious cultural differences, because everybody eats. And so it's kind of out in the open. If you ever had the chance to visit a new culture, food is the first thing you might notice because every culture has its own diet. Not only that, every culture has its own way of eating. For example, what time do you eat dinner? Is it dependent on your work day or your schedule here in the United States? Do you eat right after you come home from work or school? One of the things I remember when I immigrated was that Americans ate lunch and dinner very early. It was strange to me to eat lunch at noon and dinner at 6 p.m. Back in Russia, we ate lunch around 2 or 3 p.m. and dinner around 8 p.m. It doesn't seem like a big deal, but it's one of those differences that's very clear. And even as a kid, I noticed it, like in school. I think it's also because Americans wake up earlier for their jobs than people in other cultures. What about religion and spirituality? That's another topic that a cultural anthropologist might study. But they wouldn't stop at the obvious main religions we have around the world. Anthropologists also want to know about the very different spiritual rituals in rural parts of the world. For example, how do people hold funerals around the world? In the US, it's a sad event, maybe also a religious event. But in some cultures, this is a happy moment where people celebrate their loved ones moving on to another chapter of existence. And they have dancing and food, which also ties in with their spiritual or religious beliefs about life. In my culture, after a funeral, there is a big feast with food to honor the dead. This is kind of a show of abundance so that they never go hungry wherever they are going. Food is generally tied to many cultural traditions because it's both nourishing and symbolic. It is a giver of life and a sign of prosperity. Cultural anthropologists often find that the best way to learn about diverse peoples and cultures is to spend time living among them. For example, one famous anthropologist was Margaret Mead, and she spent a year living among the Samoans back in the early 20th century in order to understand the very different cultural patterns of that side of the world compared to her culture. She ended up describing how differently Samoans raise their children, how differently they view marriage, or how they ascribe social status in their culture. For example, think about how we get married in the United States, which is a very specific cultural ritual. And cultural anthropologists study this as well, even their own culture. So here, the woman takes the man's last name. We file taxes together, we have dependents who are our children, and we usually live in households with only our partners and children. This is actually different where I come from, where you're not supposed to move out when you reach adulthood. Actually, you stay living with your parents until you're married, and even after that, you're likely to stay with your parents. Or maybe now it becomes your parents are staying with you. Many generations can be living in one apartment, not because they can't afford different places, but because they are family, and culturally, you're all dependent on one another. You don't abandon anybody. I know this is true for other cultures, and I would say big families are the norm around the world. It is only until Western culture and modernization came along that separation of family became a thing, and honestly, it feels isolating a little bit. And if you look at human evolution, we evolved to live in big groups, raising our children by everybody in the community. Those new Western ways of living that we have now are only about 50 to 100 years old. So evolutionarily, it feels more normal to have a lot of people around you in your day-to-day life. So currently, it's standard practice among anthropologists to spend time in the cultures they are studying to better understand the perspectives, practices, and social organizations of other groups whose values and life ways may be very different from their own. So imagine an anthropologist moving to Alaska to study us. They could come from some country where they live in big cities and the climate is warm, which is basically the opposite of an Alaska. So they would be like, oh, I wonder what it's like to be totally different. They could move here to study us, quote, authentically, and record all the strange rituals we've invented on this island. Can you think of any rituals that are only done in your small town? And when I say rituals, I just mean like things that other people may not have to do because they don't live in an Alaska. And over time, it's become normal. Can you think of any? It's weird to think of somebody to come study you because for you, everything that you do is normal, right? And everything somebody from a different culture does is strange, right? Like their food doesn't bring you childhood memories, or their clothes are too fancy or not fancy enough, or you can't tell their social status by looking at them, the way you could tell something about somebody here just by looking at them. Like if somebody is wearing a suit, they must be important and work a clean job. But in other places these days, that's not the way anymore. In San Francisco, for example, many important people with clean jobs will just wear hoodies and jeans and never suits anymore. That's why when you go to another country or even to a big city in California, you can have what's called culture shock. Because all the rules you learn about how to navigate your day, where to buy food, how to interact with people is all different. For example, people in New York don't smile at you when they see you, even if you live on the same street. It's so weird. I was just there last summer, and I felt like everyone was mad at me for going on a hike if they saw me. They were just scolding at me. But in Alaska, I don't feel that way. People I don't even know wave to me from their cars. That's something that would cause culture shock for sure for anybody. And culture shock is a big deal because it's also this assumption that the way we do things is the best way. We're just not familiar with another way unless we travel somewhere. It can also become very centric. We feel comfortable in it. It becomes easy for us to understand what is expected of us, and we get used to it. We don't even have to think about it. We don't even have to think about our culture or the rituals or what to do. Here's another example, because I'm just loving telling you all these differences. In the United States, making eye contact is usually a sign of respect. In the workforce, walking tall, handshakes, and eye contact are very respected. So you think somebody has confidence if they do all of those three things, at least in this culture. But in other places, it is very offensive to look at someone in the eyes, who's older than you. It means you don't respect them. It means you think you're their equal when you're not. I know some Native Alaskan cultures also have this cultural rule. So imagine you travel somewhere, and that's one of the invisible rules that you don't follow just because you don't know. And then you're not treated nicely by others in many ways, and you don't understand why, and nobody tells you, and you just want to go home because you don't feel happy or loved, and you don't understand why. That's culture shock. To fit in as a human, the way that we live in cultural societies, we have to completely submit to the cultural norms to be accepted in a way. And I don't just mean like you can't be different or have a personality, but, you know, you can be offensive to an entire culture because those people decided this is how we do things. And this is how we respect one another. So that's what cultural anthropologists study. I also didn't mention how they studied this not only in modern times, but in past times as well. So like how people used to behave in ancient Greece, for example, or how they lived in the ancient infrastructure, and even how they went to the bathroom. Yes, that's right. Plumbing is a very modern way of life. And the only way to have large cities is to have a plumbing system, basically. And finally, I'm going to throw in the fourth subfield of anthropology that exists, and it's called linguistic anthropology. So briefly, linguistics is the study of language, right? And linguistic anthropologists are interested in how language is linked to to how we see the world and how we relate to each other. Like how many words you have for something or for an emotion reflects how important that artifact is in that culture of yours. And linguistic anthropologists can look at how language works in all its different forms, how it changes over time. It can also mean looking at what we believe about language and communication and how we use language in our lives. I won't get into this part much because I did a whole episode on language already, but it's obvious that language is super important to people and reflects so much about who we are and how we live, both before and in modern times. And for this week's resources, I'm going to just give you a bunch of really cool movies because there's been a lot about anthropology and especially about archaeology. For some reason, Hollywood loves archaeology. The first one is Nanny Diaries. And I just watched this movie. It's this young college graduate who becomes a nanny in New York City and basically analyzes the rich New York City people through an anthropology lens. It's very funny. My second suggestion is the Mummy movies. So the Mummy is a classic, in my opinion, and it's about archaeologists hunting for treasure and coming across ancient spells, and it's really action and dramatic, and the first Mummy movie is obviously the best. And how about the Indiana Jones movie? So this is about, he's an archaeologist. They're kind of old, but very popular. I think I watched one of them for class, probably to see just how wrong the movie is compared to what real archaeologists do. You have to watch the movie Time Trap. So this is a crazy science fiction movie about time, human evolution, and it also has some aliens at the end. You have to watch for it. It'll blow your mind. And finally, National Treasure, my husband's favorite movie because of Nick Cage, I guess. And there's lots of car chases, but I think he's a treasure hunter, but it's kind of on the theme of, you know, understanding the past. So kind of anthropology themed. Anthropology and archaeology are really fun fields of science. It's always interesting to learn about ourselves and study our own weird ways of existing. That's why I love science, and I've tried to share my knowledge and my interest in science through these 10 episodes of Oh Wow Science. I hope these episodes have inspired you in any way to look at the world differently, and maybe even pursue some of these subjects further. And as always, keep your ears open and keep your mind open to all the science in your life. This has been your host, Tatiana. Take care of yourselves.